Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the September 25th broadcast of Italian Tomatoes. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the September 25th broadcast of Italian Tomatoes. I'm your host, Bob Curie, and tonight is our pre-debate night show. We're going to cover a few themes that I think will help to understand the debate tomorrow night a little more comprehensively from the point of view of the people who will be watching it. First, some administrative things. The chat is open if you wish to participate in the chat. And to call into the show, the number is 646-478-0004. That's 646-478-0004. I'm hoping to have some live callers tonight. Some people had indicated that they might be calling in. Who are active in the blogosphere, and whether they'll actually show up or not, you never know. I'm hoping, and actually I think one of them has shown up. Area code 703, who is that?
Who could that be?
Who could that be?
It
sounds
no
like
idea.
It's needed by politics.
It must be, that bitch, man. She did show up, though.
Pardon me?
I said that bitch. She did show up.
She did show up. Yeah,
hi,
well, it's been a while. I mean, you know, I've been reluctant to do shows given the state of poison on the side of the aisle. Pardon me?
We have a candidate.
Yeah, I mean,
over.
I'm hoping that, you know, now everybody is going to come together and realize what's at stake and you know, bury the hatchet from the wild primary season. But, you know, you never know.
You never know.
I think,
and really,
you know,
who cares? We got a candidate, and we're going to get him elected.
we got to get him elected. I just cannot abide the idea of looking at Hillary on TV for 4 years and living with the mess she's going to create. I mean, we're getting an indicator of that already. I mean, with the news out of Syria, I mean, that thing is descending into more and more chaos and violence. And you know, that's Obama's baby. I mean, Syria.
Mm-hmm. We'll be Venezuela in 4 years if she's elected.
Yeah. I mean, that woman has such a penchant for making a mess out of everything she touches. You know, where would it end if she has the ultimate power of the presidency? I don't know.
Scary.
Yeah, it is.
Who else is on the phone with us? Anybody?
No one has called in. I'm hoping that we will have more, but, you know, you never know. I mean, we're competing
you and me, buddy.
With the NFL and, yeah.
I'm
so
boycotting the NFL. So
yeah, well,
I ain't even watching them.
The NFL, the new politically correct NFL. Yeah, that's a subject for a show all by itself. But I'm not
indeed
a big sports guy, so I'm not the best person to run that show. Well, anyway,
so what are we going to chat about?
Well, what I'm going to do is to go through my prepared remarks, and then we'll just chat about whatever strikes our fancy. I mean, I think the first thing, the thing I wanted to get across in the show is that you cannot look at these debates from the point of view of the journalistic classes who do the moderation. You have to look at how it's going to be perceived by the audience, how they think. And the two things that really struck me about the debates during this, you know, pre-debate evaluation of what's going to happen is, number one, how disconnected the journalistic classes have become from the American mainstream. So I'm going to play a couple of clips to drive that home from the show Star Trek. And then I'm going to play another clip about debates as political theater. But first, I think these two things from Star Trek, the classic episode where Kirk and Spock visit this city in the sky that is where you have elite classes totally detached from the grimy reality of the miners who provide all the wealth, I think was kind of a good way to image the debate. So I'll play these two clips.
Stratos, Captain. City actually floating in the sky.
Looks as tranquil as its reputation
is. It is one of the most interesting metropolises in the galaxy. This troubled planet is a place of the most violent contrasts. Those who receive the rewards are totally separated from those who shoulder the burdens. It is not a wise leadership. Here on Stratos, everything is incomparably beautiful and pleasant. The High Advisor's charming daughter, Droxine, particularly so. The name Droxine seems appropriate for her. I wonder, can she retain such purity and sweetness of mind and be aware of the life of the people on the surface of the planet? There, the harsh life in the mines is instilling the people with a bitter hatred. The young girl who led the attack against us when we beamed down was filled with the violence of desperation. If the lovely Droxine knew of the young miner's misery, I wonder how the knowledge would affect her. This troubled.
So that, to me, kind of symbolizes what we're dealing with the media. I mean, they are so disconnected from the reality. And it's become very apparent in the coverage of all of these violent attacks that have been occurring in the U.S. during the past few months. I mean, we saw it again last night, the night before, I forget when the incident occurred, when you had the mall shooting in Washington State, and the media started broadcasting this notion that the perp was a Hispanic male. And it turns out that he's an immigrant from Turkey. And, like, where the hell did they get Hispanic male from? I mean, they had no evidence of that, but they rushed.
Too dark to be white. They wanted to go white. These two can't.
They rushed to get that theme out because the idea of a theme that runs counter to their narrative that terror and immigration are not threats, that they can't countenance that. And then, of course, you know, the paradox of that is that so by pushing the Hispanic narrative, they insulted Hispanics. I mean,
thank God for that, man. That was just awesome.
The internal contradiction Yeah, I mean, the internal contradictions of these people, this detached journalistic class that, you know, shelters behind their affluence and gated communities is amazing. And, of course, they have the ultimate coddled gated community candidate in Hillary Clinton. I mean, that woman lives in a bubble. And Trump, for all of his hundreds of millions of dollars, mixes effortlessly with all sorts of people, whereas Hillary just lives in her cocoon, and the media aid and abet that. So that's kind of the first thing that we're going to see from the perspective of the people watching the debate, because that's going to strike them too. If they concentrate on policy wonk questions that are supposed to favor Hillary, that disconnectedness will become more and more evident as the debate unfolds. And the thing that we have to notice, too, is that the lines between the media, government, and big business are eroding in our increasingly corporatist state, and increasingly power players jump between the three. It's not uncommon for people to go from politics to media to business, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And that really is quite a change from what happened in the immediate post-World War II era. The TV and big-name print journalists were liberal, but the lines separating government, big business, and journalism were much more distinct. They had a much more professional sense that journalism should be separate, and they also came from humbler roots, often from the center of the country, and they spent a lifetime in journalism and not bouncing from government to business to Wall Street to journalism and, you know, back and forth and back and forth. Well, this kind of corporatist class will try to frame the debates, but they won't be able to define success. Success is going to be defined by the belief of the viewer, and the viewer has to decide who is presenting a compelling vision of where the country should be going. Debates are live press television, and thus they're live theater. So I have a few remarks about theater from very famous British actress Dame Diana Rigg, who commented on what makes for reality in her profession, and I'm going to play that now. My switchboard is a little unresponsive tonight, so there will be a couple of hiccups.
The play. So what do you get from a rehearsal period? What do you get from the director?
A great deal. I love the rehearsal period. It's my favorite time. I like playing, of course, but the rehearsal period is a time when you can examine everything. You can experiment wildly. Throw the net of choice, of options on a part. Very wide indeed. And then as the rehearsals progress, you distill down and down and down.
What is acting? What happens when you're acting?
I prefer to take that question from the other side. When the audience comes to the theater, they come to believe. They make an act of belief. They pay their money and sit in their seats and are prepared to believe. And you, as an actor, have to answer that belief as best you can, as truthfully as you can, in the part that you're playing. So it's a process of finding the truth within the character and playing that so that the belief is sustained.
Do you want the audience to believe that what they're seeing is real? And doesn't that sort of limit the notion of theatre as something that can excite, can shock, can amaze, can astound?
No, because reality excites and shocks and amazes and astounds. It's astonishing to me that people who can go to a cinema and be in Memphis, it's on the screen in front of them, and yet they come to the theater, and in our case it's New Carthage or a place in America, and they believe they're there with absolutely the minimal of sets to sustain their belief.
They're supposed to believe, you think, it's real, not that it's an illusion.
They want to believe that. And because they want to believe that, you must answer it. You must give them what they want to believe.
In a world of cinema and television, why does live theatre matter?
Because of what I spoke about earlier. Because of this, it's almost like a cat's cradle of threads from the actor to the audience. You can feel it. It's a sort of communion happens. I'm fascinated by quite how close the church and the theatre is. In fact, after the Dark Ages, when the theatre was dead in Europe, it sprang to life again through the church. And it's this almost tangible at times feeling that comes from the audience to you and goes from you out to the audience.
Before you get onto the stage with the audience,
the play.
So what do you get from a rehearsal?
Okay. Well, I think in that clip, she covers 2 points, which I think were very visible during the campaign. Number one, she talked about the rehearsal period as a period of wild experimentation. And that is absolutely what Donald Trump did in the primary stage of the campaign, from when he first announced in June of last year through the early primaries. He staked out a number of positions which seemed wild to a lot of people, some of which he has adhered to right to the present, some of which he has scaled back on. But that was what made him so controversial. He was willing to go where people had never gone before or had hardly gone before, and then he adjusted it as the months rolled by during the campaign. So I think that there is a convergence of what Diana Rigg was explaining about rehearsals in the theater and what Donald Trump was doing in the kind of rehearsal stage of his presidential run. And then the second longer part of that clip has to do with the skill of the actor in creating belief in the audience. And that's what it's really all about. The moderators are kind of secondary in all of that. They will judge the performance of the two candidates according to the prejudices of the journalistic class, but that is not how the millions of viewers are going to view it. The Hillary viewers will be looking to believe in Hillary and to get an affirmation of that belief, and the Trump viewers will be doing the same thing. And it's up to both candidates to deliver. And I think it's more likely that Trump is going to deliver than Hillary, even though the moderators are going to be stacked against him. So
I have no expectations at all. I am not watching to hear what he has to say. I'm watching because I'm hoping she strokes out on stage. Honestly. No, honestly, I kid you not. It doesn't matter what he says anymore.
The health issue is a big issue in this campaign, and one of the things, I mean, the internet has been very successful in circulating, contrary to the wishes of the media classes, the very real evidence of Hillary's very real health issues. So
I keep saying the devil is coming for his due. You only have to look at her and look at Bill. He's sucking them dry, and they owe him. They've made a lot of promises to him over their lifetime.
Well, you know, Reagan had this saying, and I believe it's true. He says, the camera never lies. And you cannot script a debate. It's live, and she's going to have to show up. And if she looks tired or shrewish or angry or whatever, no one can cover for her. You know, the camera is going to take that reality and convey it directly into people's living rooms. And all of the journalistic interference of the world can't stop it. And, of course, if she, you know, spaces out on stage and has weird eye movements or loses her temper or starts to harangue like a fishwife or whatever, I mean, it's going to deliver everything right into people's living room.
I think 100 million people is what they think is going to watch. I think that would be awesome.
I don't know. I mean, I have my doubts about that. I mean, I hope it's true. I mean, I hope people are that interested. We have another caller. Let me recognize our caller. Area code 775.
Yes, it is me. It is.
Oh, is that Richard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, long time no hear.
Yeah, I'm finally able to call in.
How are you
I'm
doing?
Sorry, I missed who it was. Who is it?
It's Richard Disney. He had called into the show before a few months ago, and can I tell people what you've been up to, Richard? Or
Sure.
He was out in Wisconsin during the Neyland primary race working
Me
on
too.
That. Yeah, and Jaded is on the line too, and she went up as a volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
So the two of you were working on the same campaign, although you may not never have crossed paths.
It's true, because it was just for a weekend. So that is true. But it was fun, and I like Mr. Neyland. Nice guy. Damn shame he lost.
So, Richard, do you have anything you want to say about that experience, or should I just plow ahead with our debate theme?
Oh, well, I mean, the debate theme is fine. Yeah, we knew about a week out we were going to get plowed because of, it was all hands on the establishment deck. I mean, we saw, they pulled out, Reince Priebus came to Racine, Wisconsin in the last, week and a half. And just pulled out and think of just fully activating every voter that had not even voted in the last three elections, and they got him, motivated him to go out. And I had heard he put a finger in the chest of every county chairman and just freaking rankled them until they got everybody out, and they completely smoked us. The establishment definitely rules in that district.
It is true. It is true. That is how Ken Cuccinelli, in my opinion, lost down here. The Fairfax GOP, in my opinion, worked against him and for the Democrat, for the U.S. chamber down here. So, but the bonus of something like that is Ohio is going to go Trump. And why are they going to go Trump? Because Reince Priebus, who really I don't have a lot of respect for at all, but he took away the apparatus from Kasich down there and the GOP and turned it over to the Trump campaign and, of course, the NRA, and the Tea Parties are working, which is why Trump is winning there. And I would wish that he would do that everywhere, because the local GOPs suck, and they get elected who they want to be elected. And then when they don't want you to be elected, they're not going to work hard for you at all. I mean, really, McAuliffe, that's what you chose? Yes, they did, because they were mad that Cuccinelli won a convention. So, yeah, and that's why I don't do anything with the GOP at all. I'm actually at work with veterans for Trump up here for door knocking and whatnot. So you just, they're criminals too. I mean, that's the bottom line. Burn it down, baby. Burn it down.
Well, I mean, Trump's apparent success. Of course, we have to wait for the actual votes to come in. In Ohio, I think, goes back to the wild rehearsal phase of his campaign, you know, which I was talking about before, where he went, where no Republican has gone before, has dared to go before, and he questioned the orthodoxy of free trade, as practiced by the Washington governing class, which has no sense of negotiating skill. When they negotiate a trade deal, they do these complicated multilateral deals, don't read the fine print, and give away the store. And,
right.
And you know, American industry and American workers are getting clobbered by this.
Yes, we are.
And so that was a risk he took early in the campaign, in the rehearsal phase, if you will. And it has come to pay big dividends, because it has made Ohio a very reasonable prospect to be carried by him, and it possibly may spill over into some of the other industrial Midwestern states, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. Michigan maybe is a little bridge too far, but Ohio, Wisconsin.
I just saw an article that Hillary is pulling out of Ohio. That she knows she can't win there.
Yeah.
So I had just seen that today somewhere.
And then, Richard, that point you brought up about the Republican establishment, you know, going all in for Ryan, you know, that's kind of a two-edged sword, too, because I think they did the same thing during the past couple of weeks with respect to the Never Trump people, and I think that was what eventually persuaded Ted Cruz to cave and endorse Trump.
Right.
He had no choice, because they wouldn't be able to use the apparatus of the GOP, is what he told them. He's,
it's weird because what we were able to do with Ryan, the one, I guess, win we got, was we actually forced him to change his opinion on TPP, publicly anyway, to actually kind of cave and say, oh, it needs more work, where it would have gone to a vote and it would have passed and been signed by Obama if we had not run that campaign.
Well, watch November 9th, because that'll be right back at it again. So, I mean, that's exactly what they do after every election cycle. They come in and they give the whole store away before everybody is seated. So I think
lame duck
still goes
session
through.
Is the most dangerous part of the legislative year.
It is, and it's sad. It's pathetic. But I think we've broken them at least enough to satisfy me for this election cycle. But, you know, I've had it with – I just can't stand the GOP at all.
Hey, Italian Fernandez, what do you think the prospect is? We're hoping that we've wounded Ryan enough to maybe lose the speakership or at least, you know, restrain his ability to use that power. What do you think? From the outside, I don't know.
I think it's a possibility. I mean, I think that you kind of dinged the car a little bit. If Trump wins election on the kind of trade platform he's running on, I think that may really be the finishing touch as far as Ryan and the globalist agenda. Because I think, let's say Hillary wins, I agree with Jaded, in all likelihood they will revive TPP. He will change his mind, whether he's speaker, or in the unlikely event the Democrats take the House, then it's a done deal. It will happen. But if Hillary wins and the Republicans hold the House, he's going to flip again on TPP and get it through. But if Trump wins on this anti-free trade platform and the Republicans hold the House, which I think those two events would be very highly correlated in probability, if one occurs, the other will occur, then I think the risk of rebellion by the House membership will serve to restrain Ryan on a number of things, including that.
Whether he wins again as Speaker or not really comes down to how many new people are down there, how many of the so-called conservative branch down there, Freedom Caucus, which I think is a bunch of crap too, but because it's amazing how it works down there, you know, with Dr. Beneshek for one. You know, I went down there after he won, sat there for an hour, chatted with him. Never in a million years would I think he would vote the way that he did, and nor did I think he would put Boehner in the lead there. But they whine and they dine them, and it is literally like prom week. It is, well, it's offensive is what it is, in any way, shape, or form. But nobody thought Boehner, but Boehner made himself that guy. And so all those new people coming in through the Tea Party, they had no clue. So they just, you know, as, you know, everybody likes to be liked. And that's how it happened. So it really has come down to, are they men enough, women enough to look them in the face and go, no, my constituents wouldn't want you. But it really is. It's a whore's paradise down there for a week. Let me just tell you that. So that's what
I'm saying. That's where the wild card of a Trump will really come in, because, you know, if he wins, given his financial independence and his,
right,
you know, willingness to go against the consensus, he will provide cover for a lot of people, a lot of Republican legislators, to do what's best for their constituents instead of what K Street is telling them to do. It's just a question of leadership. And there's one thing about Trump, you know, whether you love him or loathe him, he has, you know, he's the primary alpha male type. He's a leader.
You know, he wasn't my first choice, but I'll tell you, I was telling a bunch of people, he became my president last Saturday. He spoke to the Angel families. I think it was in Arizona, I want to say. And I did do a write-up on Unified Patriots about it. But, you know, he took an award from them. But he looked at those people and he told them, you're going to come out of the shadows. You're the ones who are living in the shadows, that there's no one out there protesting for you. And everyone will know your names. And I remember when he first came out a year ago with these families, and he forced Congress to listen to them, because, you know, that's been my battle since 2005 is amnesty. And so, like any politician, and he definitely is not one, I assumed that, you know, he kind of would have let them go by now. You know what I mean? Like, he'd bring them to a couple of rallies, whatever. But for the most part, they'd be left out there, because that's what politicians do. He hasn't done that. A full year later, and he is telling them that they're coming out of the shadows. And that's it. That right then, right in that moment, that's my guy. I have no problem knocking on doors for him. I have no problems making calls for him. And I have no problem giving money to him. I don't care what else he ever does. What he
family. I think that's what people want, is somebody with the courage of their convictions that's willing to go against the consensus that is clearly failing. I mean, it is failing.
It's failing.
It's failing everywhere. It's failing overseas. It's failing in the economy. It's failing with this escalating violence we see in this country. You know, we're seeing it fail again in Syria, where the, you know, whatever number of ceasefire this one is breaking down, and the violence is even more horrific. I mean, Hillary and Obama have turned Syria and Libya into Iraq hell holes. I mean,
yeah, they're
hellholes.
I mean, they're awful.
And Trump has the courage to tell the whole Washington establishment and their consensus, you're failures.
And yes, and I mean Republicans and Democrats.
Democrats,
that's a given. But the Republicans that he keeps saying elected politicians, and you know he's talking about Republicans, and you're just like, exactly. Thank you. Thank you.
Exactly. He is doing what needed to be done in the Republican Party for a very long time, ever since, I'd say, when Bush kind of went off the rails in his second term and started making all these concessions to Democrats and not standing up for himself and not standing up for controls on spending and not taking a firm line on immigration.
And then
you know,
amnesty. They're going to pass the amnesty, 06. I'm like, are you kidding me? I'm now fighting Republicans. That was the very first time I started fighting against Republicans, and it hasn't gotten any better in 10 years. That's crazy.
Well, I've been fighting. I've been fighting Republicans more than Democrats for a long time.
Because
well,
we know what Democrats are.
This has to do with the kind of the subject of the show I did a month ago, which was why the Republican Party is having such trouble. Because it has this paradigm, the Chamber of Paradise, Chamber of Commerce paradigm, about free markets good, free trade good, anything business wants good, and it's not working anymore because of a variety of reasons. The free market model.
The free market's fine. It's capitalism. It's killing us because it's cronyism.
It has been corrupted by the kind of crony capitalist, which is not a real free market. It is kind of mercantilist. Well, anyway, that's a subject for another.
That's why Trump's doing so well. And, you know, the bonus on him, he's not a Wall Streeter. He hates the Wall Street guys who make money off paper doing nothing as much as we do because he does something. He makes things. He creates things. He's not a big Wall Street shares trader guy. He doesn't like those guys. So.
He used Wall Street to help build his business empire, and he stiffed Wall Street when it was in his interest to do so. And, of course, there is a substantial contingent on Wall Street that never forgave him for that.
And that's okay, baby.
Him at their own game, you know. So, yes, absolutely. This whole paper wealth creation machine that Wall Street has created, which I think is the subject of another show at some point. But
he's the right man at the right time, just when we need one.
Yeah. Yeah. So I you know, Trump is communicating this effective vision, but Hillary has this enormous problem. It is the strategic weakness of her campaign. She has to campaign as Obama's heir, even though it is clear as crystal that a course correction is badly needed. She has to double down on all of his unpopular policies. From refugees to tax increases to immigration to Obamacare to his foreign policy to Libya and Iran, the Iran nuclear deal and the
Gene, as pretty as he is.
The Russia reset.
Russia reset, you know, the whole shebang. And this is the big mistake that she made was by signing on to his administration. Because had she stayed in the Senate, she could have formed an opposition group within the Democratic Party that continued the sort of centrist tradition that her husband was known for. But by joining him and then misbehaving in office so badly that she needed his connivance to keep the Department of Obama's connivance to keep the Department of Justice from indicting her in that crazy rigged deal with the FBI. She's Obama's creature. She has
but
to
she
run
couldn't
it.
Help herself because there were hundreds of millions of dollars to be made, and if there's something the Clintons are, they are money hungry. They believe they should have been rich all along, and their intent was always to be rich. And that's why I say the devil's getting his due, baby. They made a lot of promises.
You know, a lot of people are, you know, biting their nails on the Republican side about, you know, could Trump blow these debates? And, you know, he could. I mean, that is a possibility. But if you look at the kind of the belief model of the debate, which I'm trying to set out here, it would be very hard for Trump to derail people's belief in him unless he did something absolutely asinine, and he has to do it several times in the debate, not just once, because he's presenting a more believable picture of the state of America, you know, the struggle of the middle class, with globalization and unrestricted immigration, the problem of personal security with these terrorist incidents and the race riots that the media won't call race riots, and the exploding numbers of immigrants who are not assimilating, and the risk of the loss of cultural identity, which everybody feels regardless of race or creed or ethnicity, if they're second generation or more background in this country. It's not just a white thing. It's anybody who has roots in this country, African American, third generation Hispanics, whatever. This tidal wave.
Has he not just been all awesome,
right?
Though, with the black community? I mean, right. I mean, hey, where has that GOP person been? Why wouldn't you talk to a whole group of people who are Americans who want what everybody else wants, which is a great life for their children? How amazing is that?
To me, that's what cemented me in Trump is my guy, because he's doing something that should have been done generation ago by Republican politicians, and going to the black community and saying, hey, I know the Democrats have had a lock on you, but open your eyes. What's happening to you? He had
the
bull.
Did you see that? The Black Panthers said that, too. I think I saw it at Breitbart. Head of the Black Panthers is like, Hillary Clinton hasn't done anything for blacks. And I'm like, oh, gosh. That's amazing. Farrakhan, same thing. I mean, you're just like, wow, this is awesome.
He had the raw political courage to go into these communities that had not seen a credible Republican in a generation and say, I want your support, you know? And he really came across as meaning it.
He meant it. He wasn't faking them out. He's not reading off of totuses. He is saying it. And that's another thing I like about him is, he may repeat himself and go off into a stream of consciousness, but he's not lying because he says the same thing every time. And it's not on a screen for him to repeat. And that's when you know somebody's telling you the truth. And you're just like, oh, gosh.
Yeah, I mean, again, he is so believable, even though he'll get tripped up by facts on facts because he's not the world's best fact rememberer in the world.
He does exaggerate, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does exaggerate. You know, he is narcissistic, absolutely. I mean, he's got a lot of flaws.
I exaggerate. You exaggerate.
Believable. That, to me, is what is going to, you know, turn this debate. Do you believe in change, and do you think he's the one that can deliver it? And I think, you know, he has a very good chance of making his case in this debate, even though Hillary is a trained lawyer and, you know, she lies like as easily as some people breathe and all of that. I think he has a very good chance of doing well in the debate. And this kind of goes to the last prepared point I had, which was the whole question of debate preparation. I mean, a lot of people criticize Trump, and justifiably, as being undisciplined. And Hillary, of course, is, you know, the policy wonk with the briefcase, and she's holed up and on her estate studying like she did back in law school. And, of course, Trump
that
is not wired that way. But I think he'll do better than expected, and I got.
No, you can't. She can't study for him, though. You can't Donald Trump. You don't know where he's coming from.
I was looking at his recent rallies on TV. It occurred to me that he has become more disciplined in his rallies, and he is reading a lot of material constantly, and it's the same material from rally to rally to rally. It's adjusted a little bit, and they're filled with facts, much more so than the extemporaneous style he was using earlier this year. And if he's an auditory learner, which I think he probably is, and he's a very smart guy, which I think we would have to credit him, because nobody gets that successful without being smart. This can be very effective. I mean, he may be prepping for the debates before our eyes by this constant reading of facts. And, you know, it's like muscle memory. If you do it often enough, it's going to help him during the debate, even though he may not cram formally for the debate as much as Hillary does. So I think his preparation may be better than people think it's going to be.
Well, he's a smart businessman. That's what I tell people all the time. I mean, my goodness, they go, oh, he's stupid. Is he really? I mean, he's like most of us. I talk a certain way amongst my friends, like you guys. And then, you know, I meet people in business and I talk another way.
Right.
Doesn't make me unintelligent, just that's the way I am normally. And that's him. He's a New York City guy from one of the boroughs, not a Manhattanite. They always hated him for that. So he is this brash, you know, bull in a china shop, which I am as well. But to think that this guy didn't go into meetings with the perfect tie, you know, and the perfect pocket and a nice suit and walk in there and know everything he needed to know about that deal without cracking open a book. Well, of course, he knew everything he needed to know about it,
and
then the deal got done. So
I think people don't understand the grasp of detail that you have to succeed in the field that he succeeded in.
Absolutely.
And
well,
he hides it most
of
the time.
Stupid is the number one play in the Democrat playbook anyway. They called Reagan stupid, they called George W. Bush stupid, and they called Trump stupid. They always do that.
To the NRO guys. So, they're dead in the water.
Well,
that's,
you know,
the first thing I would like him to do is pull their 501c3. Pull it, because they shouldn't have it.
Since I've covered all the prepared things I wanted to go into, now it's time for some fun. I am enjoying the meltdown of Never Trump.
I am enjoying
it because, you know, I think it was perfectly reasonable to oppose Trump up to and including the Republican convention. But when the delegates, you know, had their say, they had their say. And people should have swallowed the decision. And you know, they didn't have to actively support Trump and
just
sing
say
his
nothing.
Yeah, but they didn't have to conduct the wrecking operation that they tried to do from late July to the time when Ted Cruz, you know, had to eat crow and endorse Trump. And all of these media or would-be media types like NRO and Red State and Weekly Standard and, you know, the whole crew.
Our intellectual leaders, Street.
I am so enjoying the egg that they've got on their face right now.
Me too. And you know what? I'll never give Cruz, who, you know, I support from the minute he was running for the Senate down in Texas, he'll never get another dime from me. I had Mike Lee's campaign call me yesterday, and I'd already told them once, don't call me again, but they did. And so I gave them a mouthful, and I just told them, I said, look, you've all told me in 2012 to get behind the open borders progressive Romney to beat Obama. I did. and you can't. I told him, I said, grow a set of gonads, suck it up, because I need the 4-year break. And that's the truth.
Yeah.
That's why I tell people, if you love me, vote for him, because I personally need a 4-year break from fighting the left all the time. And I know that Trump will fight for himself, and the people around him will fight for him, and I can stop being angry all the time at what's happening to my country, because I know he'll do the right thing by the country.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, it's so nice to have a fighter. And, you know, look, I understand where Never Trump was coming from initially. Trump
initially
was a big risk. Stylistically, he was so off the charts in terms of the norm that we come to expect from Republican candidates. So if you want to oppose him, fine. But it has to end at a certain point. It just has to. And they
At the end of the day, we're not nice. The Democrats are not nice people. They ruined good people. Todd Akin was not a bad man. They destroyed him. I will use him as an example, but you could pick 1,000 more over the last 30 years. And with the state-run media and their protection and the nastiness with which they come after people, he was the right man, because there is not another one of those other 16 that could have taken the onslaught that came at Trump. It just wouldn't have. It would have been nice. I mean, Jennifer Flowers trended all night long. So she's not going to sit there, but who cares? Everybody knows who she is now.
I mean, the whole Trump troll thing is hilarious. The way he just lives rent-free in people's minds. I mean, the way he gets under their skin. You know, it's so refreshing to have, you know, win or lose, a Republican candidate who really fights and fights to win. I mean, if we lose, and I hope we don't, but if we lose, it won't be that resentment that we've had when Romney lost and when McCain lost, because
they didn't fight.
He gave everything he had.
He left it all on the table.
Yeah, Romney and McCain pulled so many punches, and George W. Bush too. I mean, he rolled.
Imagine a conservative there, buddy.
Oh, God!
Did you see that picture of him with Michelle Obama
today?
Yeah,
I did.
Oh my God! I'm like, whoa, dude! 8 years. There's so much you could have said to save our country. You knew what he was doing. You said nothing. Now I know why. I mean, seriously, fight for America, for goodness sake. Something.
Well,
at
you know, Dick Morris.
We can be comforted that George H.W. Bush is voting for Hillary, though.
I know, but I'm not shocked there, Mr. CIA, Mr. Neocon. I mean, good gracious, I still got a Neocon T-shirt. I used to be a Neocon. I believed in the power of our military. I did not believe in nation building. And that's where they went off the rails.
I'm more of a paleocon.
Huh?
I'm more of a paleocon.
Are you? I mean, I believed in the war. I didn't have a problem. I fought for George Bush with that war. I used to go down and confront those anti-war protesters. But this is different. And Syria was the awakening for me on that. Why are you going into Syria? What do you mean,
well,
red
exactly.
Mark? What the
heck? I mean, you know, Iraq, well, that was a question mark, but, you know, at least by the time that George Bush left office, Iraq had been relatively pacified.
Right.
And Obama should have
Here's the reason that we went to Iraq, though, so that the fighting wasn't here. When we fought in Iraq, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of radical Islamists went to Iraq to kill U.S. soldiers. They didn't come to the U.S. like they are now.
It was a brilliant war plan. That's why I supported it. That's why I fought for him. I didn't care. That was a great plan right where Iraq sat. And that's why I fought for it. But these people, when you look at them now, I mean, the Wolfowitzes and the George H.W. Bush, they love war. I mean, they love it. They make a lot of money off of it. They want to be at war. That is not the neocon I was.
I'm saying what happened is they created a vacuum because Obama pulled everybody out way before there was actual, you know,
they
snapped defeat out of the jaws of victory. And now the Islamists are emboldened, and they don't have to kill, you know, they can't kill Americans in the Middle East. They have to come to the USA and Western Europe. Or, you know, not just Americans, but Westerners, Christians, whatever.
Right, but the Bill Crystal and those guys, they want war. They want to be at war. It's like they feed off of it. They're sick.
Well, what I think they want is two irreconcilable things at the same time, and that's never very good in policy. They want to interfere all over the world, but they don't want to pony up the military muscle and the sacrifice that you have to do that. So we're constantly overextending ourselves and then creating messes which we can't fix because there is just a complete mismatch between means and ends. We don't have the means to remake Syria, remake Iraq after Obama let it blow up. We don't have the means to refix it. We don't have the means to fix Libya. But these, you know, neocon people think contradictory that America
is... By the way, it's not our job. Enough is enough. It's on the other side. Let Russia handle it, for God's sake. It's their side of the world.
We actually have the means. We just don't have the will.
I don't believe we can't win anything.
We don't have the will.
And the military, you know, as overextended as it is and under-equipped as it is, I mean, we've been under-investing in the military for many years now while we have been spending, you know, like a drunken sailor on, you know, everything else, you know, with this deficit spending that we've got.
I believe our military can win anything if we go to war. We should not be rebuilding anything.
No, it's all will. I mean, we defeated the Nazi Germans, the fascist Italians, and the Imperial Japanese in less than 5 years. And we went from zero, a smaller military than we have now.
We had the will. Everybody wanted to win.
We had the will. That's the definitive thing. Also, I mean, I said right after 9/11, I wrote a blog post about it, yes, an old-fashioned blog, that the center of gravity to beat international Islamic terrorism, the centers of gravity to win that war, just like we couldn't win World War II by defeating the Nazis in France. We couldn't even win World War II by defeating Italy. We had to defeat Berlin and Tokyo, okay? In this war, from 2001, and actually earlier and even now, We have to defeat the centers of gravity are Saudi Arabia and Iran.
Saudi Arabia.
We don't have the will to take those out. We don't have the will to take them out. We don't.
Saudi Arabia, they got to go. They got to go. They the problem.
And Iran.
Well, yes, Iran, but I think Saudi Arabia needs to go first.
Iran is the largest state sponsor of terrorism. And I think if we would – here's the thing. There was no will – and quite honestly, if we took Iran down, we wouldn't have to take Saudi down.
I don't know if we can now. Look what Obama's done. $33 billion. I mean.
No will.
Well, he doesn't. He wanted them to be big.
Because of the propaganda, because of all the stuff, you know, there's no will. There's no political will. The people are so misled. They don't even know what the center of gravity. And by the way, that's a military term. You have to take out the centers of gravity to have victory in any war. And those are still the two centers of gravity. Not Baghdad, but it was Tehran and Saudi Arabia.
And Trump again. I appreciate him there, too, because he said we're not the world's police, and if we're going to do something, you're going to pay your part. Yes, you are going to pay.
Well, I would trust him to, well, obviously, you know, he'll be tougher on Iran than Obama would be, but I think he's also more inclined to stop coddling the Saudis. Now, the Saudis know damn well what the role that they have played in the rise of Islamic terror because they funded all these mosques and schools.
They sure did over here in America, too.
And they're doing it in America. They're doing it in London. They're doing it everywhere.
My kids went to a middle school that was built by the Saudis in the 70s.
Yeah, it's
that's Reston, Virginia.
And what the Saudis do, that they play both ends against the middle. I mean, they're posing as, oh well, we will be a force for moderation in the Islamic world. Meanwhile, other parts of the Saudi octopus are promoting radical Islam.
That's correct.
And they get away with it.
Well, we let them, and we always have. 40 years, 50 years, we've been talking about energy independence across GOP and DNC. And it never was until now. I mean, now we're about as close as we're ever going to get. And it's awesome. I mean, really, because they all lied. Everybody was paying the Saudis. And you're like, why? Why?
Well, because there's this illusion that the Saudis are a moderating influence, and they are not. They tactically support us in certain areas, but strategically they're always working against us.
Yes. Yes,
and
they are.
And that fools the Washington policy establishment. You know, one of the.
I don't think anybody's fooled. I never believe anybody is fooled. I think everybody down there knows exactly what's going on. Now, if I know it, and I'm just a mom down in Northern Virginia, they know it.
Yeah,
I
don't know. I mean,
I'm
kind of undecided on that, because I do believe that educated people have a very good propensity to fool themselves, especially when it's in their economic interest to do so. And the Saudis are paying off everybody in creation, starting with the Democratic candidate for the president of the United States.
$25 million right there.
And smackers from the Saudis for her so-called foundation.
It's crazy, I know.
It's just so bizarre.
It is bizarre, and that's why I want Trump to win, because I need 4 years of a break. I just need a press for 4 years. I don't know how many left-wing groups will go down in that time if our government is funding them. So half of them, maybe half, but that's okay. I need a break. That's all
I'm asking. I need one, too, because I started to get involved in all of the blogosphere crap I was working at American Airlines during 9/11, and that had a big effect on me. And then a few years, that kind of percolated and grew, and then I got active. But I've done it now for about 10 years, and I can't see doing it for much longer. So if Trump doesn't win, I may hang it up and let Gen X and the millennials.
Go get a house in the woods, whatever. Yeah, that's how I feel too. 15 years I've been at this against the left, and I've had enough. I just need a break, and that's all I'm looking at this election.
Well,
I need
Mr.
Trump to win.
Well, it's not only fighting the left, but it's also all of this stuff with your own side. I mean, I got so frustrated and paralyzed when all of the infighting broke out because of Never Trump. And I thought, my wildest days, 10 years ago, when I got involved, I would never have believed that the people that I was standing shoulder to shoulder with and supporting would be de facto Hillary supporters 10 years later. What
was
it all about?
Isn't it?
Well, they demanded that you suck it up and support Romney or Bush or whoever, right? But now they're going to take in their marbles home.
They did demand it. And you know what? We did it. And you know what? And now they won't do it. And you're right. You know what? I've lost a lot of, I'll call them associates, because obviously they were never friends, because I haven't changed. But boy, have they.
Yeah. I mean, this whole couple of years has been a revelation to us about some of the people that we thought we were aligned with in our world outlook and what they revealed themselves to be when, you know, things get rough, as they invariably do in politics, and then you find out, you know, what, who's motivated by money, who's motivated by power, who's motivated
by money.
Principle.
A lot of it by money. Isn't that shocking? Because I, you know, many people, many times I've been asked to, you know, come work for this person, work for that person, or do this or do that. And I always said no, because you get corrupted. And, you know, I have a good job and I can still do all the things that I do. And I'm glad, because I've seen them all sell out. They've just sold out for money. And it's like, really? Because America's number one to me. Money, it's great. You know, I want to pay my bills. But boy, America, I bleed red,
well,
white,
exactly.
And blue.
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, if you lose your country, I mean, what does the money in the bank do for you? I mean, there's this illusion that some affluent people think that they can shelter against the storm, that they can go with all this politically correct stuff and multiculturalism and progressive this and progressive that, but they've got enough money to protect themselves and their family against any
right.
of the negative consequences. And what these urban incidents and the riots and the terror are going to show them is, no, there's no place for you to shelter. Some of these terrorist incidents now are hitting upscale communities, you know, the way they did in New York a week or so ago, the way they did in France.
It's sad. There's no place to hide.
If your country goes down the tubes, there is no place for you to hide, no matter how much money you have.
There's nowhere to go. And, you know, they can hide for as long as they can, and maybe they got security, like Paul Ryan has security and whatnot. But you know what? When it comes, and if it comes badly, big, your security means absolutely nothing, and you've put everybody else at risk
for your
vanity.
And that's what was the big disappointment, is that, look, you know, you see it, I see it, Richard sees it, a lot of the people we associate see it, but a lot of the other people that we've been allied with, they went in a completely different direction, and it was so infuriating. And not only did they go in a different direction, but they were so nasty about it.
I know. It's amazing. Remember, was it Caleb or the other brother? I can't remember all the things he said to me. I was like, yeah, whatever. I've heard that from the left. It means nothing
to you. Just nastiness. Oh, how can you be an ignorant Trump supporter? You're this, you're that, you're the other thing. It's like, that was just uncalled for. I mean, if we had to disagree, then we disagree. But, you know, don't get personal.
They definitely made it personal, and I will look forward to each and every one of them, each and every one of them being poor, broke, and begging in the next 5 years.
I don't want anybody
I will
to
enjoy
be
it.
Poor, broke, and begging, but I do want them to repent their ways, you know?
There isn't enough repentance at all. As you know, I'm not a religious girl, so. Poor, broke, and begging. That's what I'm looking for.
Because
I'm a mean girl.
If never Trump gets their way, we'll be poor, broken, begging. So.
I think I'll make it till I die, actually, based on what I do for a living and whatnot. But the next generation, boy, are they screwed if you don't win.
They really are. I mean, I really feel sorry for the millennials, because this is really the best chance they're going to have. I mean, if Hillary gets her way, she gets in, and she creates her nightmare regulated economy that's taxed and regulated to death, they're going to be living in mom's basement until the end.
Yeah, till the end. You're right. I think I'll be all right, but they won't be. And this is my last battle for them, because after this, in my opinion, it's their turn. step up.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, Yada, that is exactly how I feel too, which is, you know, after putting up with the emotional turmoil of seeing our movement split the way it did this year, I want to rest too. I'm not going to put up with this anymore.
Nope.
And, you know, and I, of course, I'm a little older than you. You know, I have to think about
your sanity.
Caring for the afterlife and maybe having a little rest before I go.
before you rest. I hear you.
A rest before I rest. Exactly. So it's going to be. The torch has to be turned over to the next generation. You know, like Richard, he's got a few good years left in him.
How old are you, Richard?
Old enough to know better.
Old enough. Well, I'm 50, so I've had enough
already. I'm in my mid-60s now, so I don't see doing this in my 70s. I just don't.
Nope, me either. I just want a 4-year break. And you know what? The GOP, if they want to bring somebody on to take him on in 2020, feel free to do it. But at least I got that 4 years, and all I can tell people.
You have a 4-year break, and I think it may only take him 4 years to put the ship on the right path again. I mean, the Republican Party.
Stop paying La Raza, BLM. Those are tax dollars that they took from those banks. So they fine the banks. They put the money, people don't even understand that. So they move the money to accounts, and they're paying these groups, these anti-American groups, just that alone. So, of course, La Raza will stay around because they're huge, but I think BLM will crack up because they're not as huge. And Soros, of course, is going to die. But just those small things, just in that 4 years, just getting the government to stop paying these anti-American groups, that's going to be huge. It'll take them a while to rebuild if he were to lose in 4 years. That's why I say 4 years, it'll be fine, because half of those groups will be gone by then. And that's, I mean, the fight is way deep. People are always looking, you know, at like, okay, ISIS, this, that, and the other. But I see that left-wing gravy train that is going out with our tax dollars or the money from the banks, and people don't even realize that. But if they did, they'd want that to stop too. So
they'd want it to stop. They have no idea what will hit them once Hillary has the levers of power, because Obama had one saving grace, which was he's kind of lazy. But Hillary is just a relentless busybody. She will just corrupt and connive and game
the system.
She is dedicated to controlling every aspect of your life, Italian Tomatoes, and mine.
That's right.
I mean, think about McAuliffe, those guys who are younger, like in their 50s, they're all still going to be around her. So, I mean, even if she has terrible medical issues, these corrupt SOBs will be right there. That's why she's got to lose, because, yes, it'll be 10 times worse than it is under Obama as it comes to regulations and paying left-wing groups. I mean, you think tax dollars are going to Planned Parenthood now? Well, they will never have to charge anybody for an abortion again, because Hillary Clinton will make sure that all of them are paid for with our tax dollars. So, I mean, the religious right people who have fallen into this not Trump thing, they just are not thinking at all.
Well, yeah, exactly. And, you know, the Mormon contingent too, that followed Romney's lead and, you know, tried to split the party because
who
they
are those people, by the way? I never even paid them any mind, but now all of a sudden I don't like these people and I don't even know them. I mean, seriously.
So I don't know. I mean, I've saw some comments that Richard made in the chat, and, you know, he's kind of negative about our prospects and these comments. But, you know, who knows? I mean, I agree. I mean, you know, Hillary went into this campaign with a big advantage, but Trump has consistently surprised on the upside. contrary to expectations, especially back in middle of August, where everybody was writing him off because he made some mistakes, and of course the media.
She was measuring the drapes, is what I remember from August.
Pardon me?
She was measuring the drapes.
Yeah, she was
measuring.
That's
what I remember.
And the media was trying to, you know, do the blitzkrieg with
mm-hmm.
the polls, and Trump hasn't got a chance. Hillary's got it in the bag. It's all wrapped up. It's she'll win like 45 states. He might as well pack up and go home. I mean, they were just pulling every stop out.
And now she's leaving Ohio. Ohio. Ohio,
yeah.
People. That's all I ever hear every election. Ohio. Wow, that's huge. Huge.
So we will see. I mean, you know, it just depends on enough people looking at the world around them and saying, hey, this is not a normal election. I'm going to go out and vote. Which
monster votes. They're there.
To ask Richard, has he been in touch with our favorite non-voter? What is he up to?
He's planning on starting his show the Friday before the election.
And he's not going to vote?
And having a big thing, you know, and predicting the winner of the election. And then having the next show after the election happens and gloating.
And gloating.
I think Trump's going to win. I think he is. 120,000, I think. Already voted down in Florida. This monster vote, and I know, I mean, because I went to the very first rally here in Virginia just so I could see, because I was a cruise backer, who are these people? And they're not people I would normally have seen. You know, farmers. There were quite a few black people there, retired military. And let me tell you, I've been going to these Vets for Trump dinners and whatnot, and it's massive. There's 800,000 retired military in the state of Virginia. They are working to get out the vote for them for Trump. So I'm telling you, it's a different breed. I knew it was a movement then. I still thought Cruz stood a chance because Trump gave him cover, you know, in the media. But I'm telling you, it's different. These are not like, you know, the people we're accustomed to every 4 years trying to talk ourselves into going out and voting for Romney or McCain. These are people who would have voted for McCain because of Sarah Palin, not because of McCain, who really did not like Romney at all, or Paul Ryan for that matter. This is a different beast, this movement of people. So I think that's why I think he wins. I think you're going to see actually Reagan numbers. The only other time I've seen that thus far was during Obama's campaign.
Well, yeah, I mean, Trump is doing what Obama did, which is to bring a lot of people who were, you know, maybe nominally attracted to the Democratic Party and,
mm-hmm.
you know, is doing the same for the Republican Party, but who would never vote, and now he's saying, you know, get out and vote. And
yep.
So they're going to get out and vote. That's my hope for,
no,
of course, then there are people like Johnny who are going to probably stay home, but
that's
nothing
okay.
you can do about
that. It's like
them.
The Never Trump. I think they're about 7%, honestly. If they're that, maybe 5%. But I think the Democrats alone, I mean, if you think about Richard in West Virginia, I mean, West Virginia, which had been a Democrat for, what, 40 years? Those people there are the same Trump people, and they flip that state. Those are – we used to call them blue dogs. You just don't see them anymore in the Congress, but they never went anywhere. They're still there. They'd like to come back out, but there's no one in their party who even comes close to them. They're so far left. There's those
people. Oh,
absolutely. People,
I mean, the Democrats just gave that state away with their insane, you know, global warming stuff, and, you know, Hillary saying she'll put the coal industry out of business.
Right.
And, you know, These miners are, you know, they're proud guys. They're blue-collar guys. They don't want to, you know, become word processors in an office.
Or they, live off the government. They don't want
or
to.
Or live off the government. They're proud of their trade.
Geez, that's a whole other
thing. And they want
word
to continue. And yet these liberal ideologues want to, you know, put them on the bread lines. And that's what's
going
to...
I was
going
to say, now word processors are being replaced by foreign workers in the white-collar zone.
Yeah.
By
it's
Democrats.
True. It's true. I mean, I just saw McDonald's.
H-1B.
700 accountants they're letting go and asking for H-1B visas to bring in people from India for accounting
and
work. That's white-collar.
Yeah.
And where
the
is this
Jaded? Thing is that...
What's that?
Jaded, where was that, the accountants? Where, what company
across,
or state or...
McDonald's?
I don't know which that... Chicago? There you go, Chicago. Okay,
no,
so,
no,
I mean, my God.
If you look up McDonald's H-1B replacements, Italian tomatoes, you'll find it. And also IBM, Disney. There's a lot of companies doing it now, and the insidious part is they're bringing these H-1B people in. They're bringing them in from Pakistan and India and wherever, and the employees are it's, the standard is a 90-day program, and the employees that are there have been there for years are told, you are being let go. You must spend a month with this newbie coming in and observing you doing your work. Then you have to do a month of training them, and then you have to do a month of them doing your work and you looking over their shoulder, and then it's goodbye. And if you complain or testify or even say anything against it, you're going to lose your severance. You're going to lose your pension. Whatever benefits you could have gotten, you're out.
But it's illegal on top of that. I used to do H-1B visas for a company I worked for engineers. And, yes, there were not necessarily environmental engineers or different types of engineers. But you have to, the letter of the law is that you must look for an American worker first. Now, of course, the government under Obama and left-wing government is not holding companies to that. But what they're doing is illegal. That is another reason to get Trump in there, because he's going to make them pay. They need to go to jail because it's illegal. You have to find an American worker for an open job before you get an H-1B visa for someone out of the country. But they're just illegals. Nobody's doing it.
They game the system because first they say, we can't find anybody who's qualified. And then they play games with the qualifications to make sure that they can't find anybody who's qualified domestically.
Well here's the thing.
But they
it's
won't do it under
that.
A Trump.
No, it's even worse than that. It's not that they can't find anybody that's qualified. There's someone
they're getting
that's
rid
qualified
of them.
In the position now.
They're getting rid of them. Did you not know that, Street? Because that's what's going on.
Yeah, they're firing existing employees and replacing them with foreign workers.
Right, and it's illegal. It is illegal. There's been no change in the law at all.
Hey, but
so these major corporations...
They game the legal system. See, this is what Trump's appeal is that he cuts through the legal arguments, and what is the famous word? The word he made famous, rigged system.
Yep, it's
rigged
a rigged
system.
Yep.
And you know, that's what's going to cut. This subject will probably, you know, come up in the debate, and Hillary will go, oh, no, these H-1B people are only being hired when they can't find a qualified person, and Trump will
And he'll bring up Disney. He'll bring
I
up Ford.
I hope, because here's another one to look up, Abbott Labs. I spoke personally to people at Abbott Labs, let go several hundred of them. In north, right just south of Wisconsin border, Abbott Lab. And, I mean, Nealon went there. We all went there and talked to him.
I remember when you guys
did
that. I saw that right up.
Sarah Blackwell, who's based in Sarasota, Florida, she's pro bono work. She's a lawyer, and she's made it her mission to defend these people let go under the H-1B program nationwide. If you look her up, you'll find a whole bunch of
Nealon needs to run again and then put the whole 2 years into it because – I think more time, I mean, just knocking on the doors there were even Democrats. And my argument to the Democrats were, this was funny as hell, I'm like, if you go out and you vote against him, at least the DCCC will spend money in your district. They're not going to against Ryan because they can't afford to do it.
Right.
That was my...
Yeah, no, you know, the fact that... What did Nayland get? 15%?
Yeah.
I mean,
15% more than anybody else ever got.
Yeah, but, you know, the I don't know. I don't know. That hill.
I know. He's got a company. He's got a life. I know. But I'm telling you,
I'll
think
you
if he...
I'll tell you this, too, though. Our telemetry, our internal poll showed us at about 30%. Seriously. Like, and we had outside agencies doing full-on scientific polling of over 2,000 people. Okay? So our polling was showing 30 to 35%. It's still hokey to me how it all rights comes in. All that, you know, and it always rings in my mind. It's not who casts the ballots, it's who counts them. And they had utter control of every freaking county
yes.
chair, every
yep.
county apparatus, down to the secretary level. I mean, they controlled everything. So I have in my mind, I mean, talk about rigged system, but I just think there's no way we only got 15.
And that's where Dan comes in. Get in the party. 50% of the seats are empty. Take over the party, because if you're not in the party, you can't take the party over. Mr. Dan is absolutely 100% correct about that, and I tell people that all the time now. Do not just sit back. Get in the party, because you can break them internally. And that's the only way we're ever going to do it, is if 70% of the seats in the precinct are controlled by real conservatives, not the GOP brand of conservatism, which is bullcrap. There is no such thing. But, yep, that's
well,
the truth.
You know, and that's kind of, we're almost at the end of the show. That's what I'm hoping, is that Trump may be the catalyst for changing how the Republican Party sees itself. And if that's successful, then we may
get
more fresh blood coming in. But the existing kind of ruling consensus in the Republican Party, which is business that, as usual, is good, and we can get along with the Democrats, and, you know, corporate
yeah,
America
that's never
is
gonna
always
work.
Going to work for the benefit of the American citizen, all of that has to go. And it took a billionaire businessman to shake that paradigm, and I just hope he's successful, because... You know, I don't know what happens to the Republican Party if he loses.
Well, we deserve it. I know that. We deserve it. We've earned it. We've worked hard for it. And we deserve him to win and turn that party upside down, because they lost their way under George Bush. Under George Bush.
Under Bush,
because he
I
was
agree.
Spending
they
like
lost.
Crazy.
They just
imagine
didn't.
A conservative.
The reality in the world was changing around them, and they wouldn't change with it. So what worked in
yep.
1950 and 1970 and 1990, they kept saying, oh, well, it'll work again, but it won't work again, because too much has changed, and Obama
mm-hmm.
and the Democrats have corrupted too much of the system.
Nobody trusts the government anymore. I always say to people, you know, it's a sad thing. I was raised to respect the government. I don't trust any of them. I think they're all corrupt now. I have no trust in any division of the government at all. And that's sad, because we were raised to respect them, but they took too much power, and they are bullying we the people. And I don't trust them at all. None of them. That's the idea.
And that's what this
matter.
Election is all about. And on that note, I think we're going to
yeah.
call it a night.
No, it's been fun.
Jaded, it was fun. Richard, thank you for calling. Tell Johnny
thanks.
To get his act together and do a show before Election Day. God, I mean, you know.
Nice talking
yeah.
to
yeah.
you, Richard.
Get his work.
You guys
yeah,
have
no.
a great week.
All right, guys. And for anybody listening in archives, we'll be doing I'm opening the chat tomorrow for the debate. You can check in the chat and vent. And have a great evening, and we'll be back. Have a good one.